Hello, this podcast contains bad language. Sorry. Also, if you're someone that doesn't enjoy brilliant, entertaining, fun introductions and just wants to get to the chatting with the guest part, then skip to around 8 minutes 10. That's where you'll find Richard. Cheers.
I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke. My name is Adam Buxton, I'm a man. I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Going all around there. How you doing, listeners? I hope you're okay. Adam Buxton here. Welcome to podcast number 24. Well, a lot's happened, hasn't it, since I uploaded the last podcast? And that's putting it mildly. But I guess the main thing, of course, is that Rosie is now internationally famous. I uploaded a video of her jumping about in a field near our house. In fact, I'm walking by it right now. It's called Rosie Dog in Field Bouncing. That's the name of the video. It describes what is happening in it. And I put it up on YouTube, and within a couple of days, it had around 100,000 views. And I told my son, my 13-year-old son, that Rosie had gone viral. So he looked up the clip on YouTube. And when he saw how many views it had, he looked at me with total pity and said, "Dad, 100,000 views is hardly viral." Wah, wah. I was a bit deflated. But in the next few days, I was approached by several agencies. They have all these agencies now that get in touch. If a video goes viral, they get in touch with the person that uploaded it and they say, "Hey, look, if you sign up with us, then we'll help you license the clip to TV stations and you'll get a cut of the money and all that stuff." But I thought, no, I'm not going to bother because I want Rosie to run free. IRL and OTI on the internet. I don't want people to have to wade through adverts before they watch Rosie bouncing around in a field for 20 seconds, you know? Unless, of course, there's a huge amount of money on offer. But so far, that has not been the case. Anyway, evidently, numerous people have just gone ahead and nicked the video off YouTube and reposted it on their pages. And there's one page on Facebook that a few people told me about, where it's sitting currently, and it has around, well, the last time I looked, around 5.5 million views. A fact that I was happy to point out to my son while dancing around and shouting, "In your face!" In other news, and on the subject of Rosie, I'm afraid to say that there has recently been quite a bit of disagreement within the house about how Rosie should be treated. Some people seem to feel that there are too many restrictions being placed on Rosie and that she should be allowed to run about wherever she likes and be in charge of her own destiny. Other house members feel that the restrictions aren't that extreme and it's important that we all stick together so that we can look after Rosie and make sure she doesn't run off and terrorize the cows and needlessly antagonize the deer community. But it's all got very heated, and opinions are very strong and polarized. And then the other weekend, my mum and my brother, Uncle Dave, came round along with our friend Dan. And Danny and my mum said that they thought Rosie should be allowed to do whatever she wants. And the cows can look out for themselves. And as for the deer, they're always causing problems, so screw them. That's what they reckoned. Anyway, some of the children started calling Granny a racist, which wasn't very helpful. Granny told the children that they were naive and that they should have more faith in Rosie. And actually, she also did say some racist things. And I just got fed up with the whole thing. You know, I was like, what's happening to us? We've got to stop the bickering. So I came up with a brilliant idea. What we're going to do is we're going to put it to the vote. And I'm pretty sure that'll sort everything out. Because then the children and my wife and Granny and Danny and Uncle Dave will feel they've had their say and that they've been listened to. And then I can just tell my mum not to interfere anymore and I can go back to running the house the way I want to. Good plan, isn't it? I'll let you know how it turns out. Anyway, let's escape together for a while and think about this week's podcast, which I've split into two parts, both featuring conversations with Richard Ayoade. Yay! You know who Richard Ayoade is. I mean, I really don't think I need to tell you too much about him. I was first aware of Richard when he did Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, along with Matt Holness, Matt Berry and Alice Lowe. And thereafter, he appeared in shows like The Mighty Boosh and Nathan Barley, and then, of course, The IT Crowd, which I guess is what he is perhaps most well known for. But Richard is also a director who cut his teeth on Dark Place and then helmed a number of music videos and has since made a couple of feature films. Submarine was his first one in 2010, starring Sally Hawkins and Paddy Considine and Craig Roberts and Yasmin Page and Noah Taylor. And then there was 2013's The Double, starring Jesse Eisenberg and Mia Wasikowska. That's disrespectful and racist. Over the last few years, Richard's also been doing a bit of presenting. Channel 4 viewers know him as the host of Gadget Man, and more recently, the host of Travel Man, in which he is joined by a different guest each week to spend 48 hours in a variety of holiday destinations. And I was very pleased to get the call earlier this year to be a guest on that show. And in May of this year, 2016, we went to Lisbon, westernmost city in Europe, and home to a certain treaty, of course. If we'd known then what we know now, we might have gone along with a biro, made a few alterations, especially to Article 50. But instead, we just wandered around being glib. And between setups, I would whip out my voice note recorder and I would enter podcast mode, which it has to be said is not Richard's natural setting. He's a shy, modest man and softly spoken, which can be tricky when you're recording a podcast on a plane or in a noisy Lisbon street. But I hope you'll get used to the ambient noise fairly quickly. And enjoy listening to me and Richard bollocking on during one of his rare podcast appearances, as he made plain on the plane.
I really think there's no need to record anything I say. I'm doing this because I like you.
How about, you've been on other
silence podcasts,
right?
I was on the Nerdist podcast.
Uh-huh.
And they subsequently said it was the worst experience they'd ever had.
When did they say that?
Someone tweeted it to me.
I don't believe that that's true.
Yes, no, they did. They had an interview with Joan Rivers, and she said, "Who's been terrible? Come on. Just be honest, who's been the worst?" And they went, "No, you know, everyone's great, people have different energies." And she said, "Oh, come on, someone must have been dog shit." And they went, "There was this one guy."
To Lisbon.
Yes.
And we're up in business class while the crew are back in economy.
You insist on that. I thought it was a strange email to receive, but I don't know. That's kind of how it works.
I don't like sitting with them.
This makes everyone concerned look pretty bad.
Well, to me, it's great.
Right. In what way?
Because I really love being up at the front of the plane.
Okay.
And it's my dream, as I've mentioned on this podcast before.
Why?
Because I'm like a little small man.
I feel incredibly guilty all the way through. Oh, look, your...
my drink's arrived.
Your rose water has arrived.
Okay. Sure, absolutely. I'll tell you what, we'll put them in the middle.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure, that would be great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you
so much. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
I don't feel guilty at all.
Really?
No, I don't think so.
I feel very guilty.
Do you?
Yes.
Well, yeah. If you feel so guilty, why don't you just go back and sit there? Sit in the back.
Because I know how much this means to you. That's why. And, well, you can't as well, can you? You're not allowed to... You used to be able to change airline tickets.
Right.
And I tried to do that once. This sounds very self-aggrandizing. In a backwards
kind of way. Oh, did you try and say, listen...
I tried... I was doing a film in America, and I was so tense, because I've only done one film in America. This wasn't like one of a series of films.
Neighborhood Watch was it called?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
the
it
Watch.
Ended up being called The Watch because of Trayvon Martin. That
right.
Case.
Okay. Thank you. We just got some nuts.
Oh, thank you. That was good for sound. And as part of SAG rules, they have to fly you first class.
And you asked to be downgraded.
No, there was someone else who looked like that. I just thought, could I give this flight to someone else?
So what, was this person...
Well, you can't...
They
you
looked
can't
elderly
swap,
or...
Yes, but you can't. They said you can't swap before
so you
for
tried
security
to give up
reasons.
Your nice seat because you're a nice guy?
No, guilt. I don't think guilt is evidence of niceness. I think it's probably more evidence of monstrous self-regard.
If you know that, then why can't you just get over your guilt?
Well, is guilt a rational process? I think you possibly can realise what you're doing, but I don't know that you can necessarily straightforwardly get over it.
Yeah. Anyway, the outcome
of
all this...
I'm not really doing much to help anyone, I'd say.
Well, you're entertaining people. That's a valuable job. You're making hours pass more pleasurably for people.
I think on balance, I'm probably making it worse. If you average it out.
Also, you're supporting your family. That's a good job.
I don't allow them access to the funds. That's part of it. Yeah, yes, I guess.
Now, listen, man.
Go
this
on.
Is a good job you've got, right? But it's weird for you, though, because you're not a natural traveller.
No, I have motion sickness on nearly everything.
Oh, right, so you literally suffer physically.
Yes, it's a strange... I guess the premise of it is that I would ideally not travel in some ways.
What's your problem with travelling?
I don't really feel the need to go anywhere. I like the Benedictine monk model of existence. Can't. You stay in one place, that's it. I don't like leaving... my wife or children for any length of time, really.
Sure.
I'd say that's the main component of it now. I can understand the idea of someone emigrating and going somewhere else for a while.
But traveling for the sake of it. There
is something slightly silly about going somewhere so briefly.
You're aware that you are systematically undoing the entire premise of your BAFTA-nominated show.
I feel that is the only thing I do within it is undermine the show. But I can't help but seem to undermine my own flimsy excuse for existence.
That's just a pose, though, right?
It's a pose. Normally I'm like Kanye West.
Yeah, when you're not doing a podcast, you're swaggering around.
Yeah, in my own self-designed denim wear. Saying, this is the kind of denim Jesus would have worn if he could afford it.
Talking about things with Richard on the aeroplane. Every now and then the subject changes and we talk about something else. On this occasion, the conversation turned to movies
or films.
It's
one of my favourite things to talk about. And my first question was, who's a good director in your book who's working at the moment and keeps churning stuff out? Good question.
Who's a good director in your book who's working at the moment who keeps churning stuff out?
Well, I don't know if it's to churn stuff out, but I think Jonathan Glazer's very good. Under the Skin.
Oh my God, that was good.
Really good. And I really like Birth and Sexy Beast.
I haven't seen Birth. Sexy Beast I love.
Yeah. Birth is great. Everything, yeah. They're all
is Birth good?
Really good.
Oh, okay.
I think it's really good.
I don't know why it never occurred to me to see it. It just...
I think he's brilliant, and I think Joanna Hogg is very good.
Yeah, what did she... Does she do Ratcatcher?
Archipelago, no. Lynn Ramsey.
Lynn Ramsey did Ratcatcher.
She's good, too. Yeah, Lynn Ramsey's good. I like that... She hasn't done anything for a while, but I like this Bulgarian director called Barbara Albert, who did...
Has she done anything with Will Ferrell living in a...
Yeah.
Unlikely.
She did Elf
world.
2.
Okay, good.
She did a film called Free Radicals, Northern Skirts, maybe? Yeah. They're sort of interweaving narratives with some magic realism. And Paul Thomas Anderson, sort of a theme.
Mm. Have you seen his Radiohead video?
Yeah, I really liked it.
It's good, isn't it?
Mm. Yes, it was nice to see him operating in a contemporary world.
Uh-huh.
It's been a while since Punk Drunk Love.
Yeah, that's right.
So that was interesting.
You didn't read any of the YouTube comments under there, did you?
No.
No, why would you?
Measured and generally positive.
Well, there were a lot of positive ones, but you could divide them fairly easily into three categories. First category, Radiohead fans that loved it.
Yeah.
Thumbs up. Second category, boring, pretentious. Why can't they go back to doing songs with guitars on them?
Right.
And then the third category was comments about Tom York's appearance.
Right.
Namely, he's old. Why has he got old?
Right. Yes, why has he got old?
That's what I want to know. It seems very indulgent.
You know him, do you?
I mean, I know him to say hello to.
And have you confronted him about his...
I'm going to.
..willful ageing?
Yeah, why have you got old?
God, one absolute...
What a prick.
Yeah.
I mean, come
let's
on.
Let's call it what
that's
it is.
Exactly.
That asshole...
Why would you do that?
...deliberately ageing to affront everyone
when
else.
So many people are invested in you not...
Yes.
Aging.
Allowing his face to decay in the way that he's wantonly doing.
Have you got the record yet?
Yes, I did the real dad thing and have bought the, you know, the vinyl.
Oh, the whole big shebang.
Yeah, like a mojo reader.
Yeah, because you still like owning physical objects.
Yeah, because it makes me feel alive to... buy things.
That's
so,
not the future. The future is...
Records as gas.
It does seem weird, though, that we are from a generation that did... Well, you're younger than I am, but certainly
so
when
much.
I was growing up, it was all about acquisition of physical detritus.
Yes.
Piles and piles of VHSs, CDs.
My dad fixed televisions and videos. That was his job.
Oh, yeah.
So we always had lots of that kind of stuff.
Mm.
So, yes, I hoard. I'm trying to de-hoard.
Was your dad a sort of engineer guy then?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
What did he used to do? Like,
well, before
he started repairing tellies?
He did all sorts of things. He taught at the University of Ibadan for a bit in Nigeria, and he also drove a cab in Britain.
In the UK? Wow.
Yeah.
What was that like for him? Did he ever talk about it?
I mean, he wasn't a big one for talking about himself at all.
And yet you've turned out so
different. I know.
Different.
I've become Ned Sheeran. Yeah, electronics. That's what he did. But so I could fix a few basic faults with videos.
Right.
What
kind of faults? Scanning?
Scanning, jam tapes. I could take the top off. I could do some minor soldering.
Soldering. Do you still solder?
I don't still solder.
You haven't soldered on?
Well, I have. Come now. A lot of it was just him looking through circuit diagrams and then him telling me to solder this joint.
That sounds like a cool thing to say. Solder this joint!
Yes, solder it. I quite like it.
Did you have good bonding sessions over electronics then?
It was nice. I did like sort of being in the shed, fixing things.
Have you got a shed now?
We don't really have enough garden space for a proper shed. I would like a shed.
You don't have, and I hate to use the phrase, man cave.
Not in our house, but that is not a problem.
I mean, it isn't strictly okay to have a man cave, is it?
I don't know. I think it's okay if you have the space. As long as you're not kicking out a child from a bedroom.
No, and as long as you're not ignoring problems that need addressing within the relationship.
Oh, you can do that within the main body of the house. You can do that anywhere.
Where do you go to do that?
You just shut down. You shut down in the conversation. You just shut down. I'm going in on myself now. The emotion's rising too high. I can't cope. I imagine being married to a man.
Yeah.
Pretty hard. I guess.
Yeah, let me hold this for you.
While I open my peanuts.
Yeah, you.
This is going to get disgusting.
It's nuts with raisins. Quite delicious, aren't they? We're just tucking into our bags.
But you see, I really enjoy listening to your podcast and listening to other people talk. And there is something odd about wazzing on yourself, isn't it?
Of course, yeah, and expecting other people to be interested.
You know that Jack White song? Oh, I guess it's White Stripes on... Is it called Little Room?
Yeah. When you're in your little room.
Yes. And there's something about that whereby people in their little rooms are doing it because they're not very good at being in the world. You sort of want people to see something, but you're probably not equipped to be able to talk about it without adopting some kind of monstrous persona. It's like there's a David Lynch, there are many funny David Lynch clips. I like this one where he says, you work on a film for a long time, and then people say, talk about the film. But the film is the talking. There's something really funny about how elevated he gets. But, you know, yeah, I guess, you know, it's been, you know, like in Razorhead and those films, he puts all of the dust bunnies under the radiator. You know, everything is really composed. So probably if he were able to in 10 minutes say, well, it's basically about a man, he's a bit worried. I don't know why suddenly he's speaking this voice.
Yeah, that's how he really speaks.
He's worried about,
he's having a baby,
he's a bit worried about it, and you know, it's a bit of a nightmare, isn't it, the stress that the stress gets to him, and but so, you know, it's kind of that. And the one with the face, with the kind of old big face, and that's probably, that means his fear. You know, it would all become so uninteresting.
Well, of course, that's right.
But it's really interesting hearing other people talk. It's
But you can talk around things. Mm. You don't have to be...
These are excellent peanuts.
They're good, aren't they? And when you get the occasional raisin...
Raisin as a treat...
Right, we are...
Yeah, we're landing.
We're descending.
I was riding in an aeroplane when it began to plummet to the ground. I was crying and I said some prayers.
But then it turned out that the plane was simply coming into land. Gosh, I was relieved that I wasn't going to die. My friend said, it's okay now, you can let go of my hand. And I'm sorry to remind you, you're still going to die, just not today.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have just landed in Lisbon. Please remain seated with your seatbelts fastened until the fasten seatbelt sign is switched off. It was a pleasure having you with us today, and we'll look forward to welcoming you on board again soon.
I don't know that they really feel it is a pleasure. I think they may just be saying that.
I think it was a pleasure serving us because we were very nice.
You weren't that nice. You were constantly flipping her off.
In a very funny way. Looking nice out there. Sunny day in Lisbon. Are we going to go out tonight and get absolutely hammered?
I'm going to canter through Hedda Gabler. And that's not a euphemism. I am actually going to just read it.
Hello, Adam Buxton here, just setting the scene for the next chat section. Our first night in Lisbon was spent in the kind of fancy boutique hotel in which you might expect to find Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon filming an episode of The Trip. The next morning, Richard and I had breakfast together, And after 45 minutes of Michael Caine impressions, we started to talk about films again, which we continued to do at various points throughout the day. First, while we were being filmed riding around Lisbon in a tuk-tuk, and later, in the streets outside a tinned fish emporium in the centre of town. It's fun talking to Richard about films. He has less mainstream taste than I do, and after speaking to him, I'm always inspired to actually watch one of the foreign and art house films I've dutifully bought over the years, but never actually removed from their packaging. We talked about one of Richard's favourite filmmakers, Michael Haneke, focusing on his 1997 film Funny Games in particular. And be warned, the conversation does refer to details in the plot of that film which might spoil your enjoyment should you wish to see it in the future but haven't yet. If only there was a pithier way of saying that. I know. Be warned, the conversation does contain plot flags. But first, I wanted to address some less than enthusiastic comments that Richard had made about one of my favourite films from the beginning of this year.
I was very shocked to hear you being disrespectful about The Revenant.
Oh, yes, sorry.
One of the big Oscar winners of last year. I mean, it won Oscars. What about that?
Well,
I mean, doesn't that prove Oscars. To you that you're wrong?
Yes.
What's your problem with The Revenant?
Mulholland Drive lost out to A Beautiful Mind, I think.
Yeah, but Mulholland Drive didn't have a movie
mass
story
montages.
About a guy, yeah, with numbers flying through the air while he did calculations in his beautiful mind.
You're right.
So what do you think about that?
I know.
Well, and now you're bringing down The Revenant. What?
Well, I'm not bringing it down. I just found it quite funny in parts.
Yeah.
I think everyone concerned has a great deal of ability. And they really did great pretending.
Right, okay.
But I did find the... There was a lot of... it did...
Who's that? Tom Hardy?
Tom Hardy.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of...
Oh, look, you're being sprayed with sun cream.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Can I hold that
for
you? Can I... Yeah, man, you've got to be responsible.
I know. Yes, I feel bad because, you know, no one wants...
Were you not...
No one wants to...
And, I mean, you were even lampooning the bear attack.
Well, the bear attack... I remember reading just when Leonardo DiCaprio raped by a bear. I didn't think... I mean, unless I missed something, I think he was just being mauled. I didn't think the bear was sexually interested in him. I certainly think the bear would have tried to get consent. I just think the bear was trying to defend her young.
All right, we've got to pause because we've got to film a sequence on a tuk-tuk.
Yes.
Which is like, what is a tuk-tuk? It's like a little golf buggy, fancy golf
three-wheel.
Buggy.
Does it have to have three wheels?
Yeah, maybe.
No. Right. Oh, here we go.
Okay. Right. Picking up our Revenant convo, where were we? You were saying that it was just too mumbly and ludicrous for you.
Well, there's quite a lot of mumbly acting, although I do like those actors. I think Leonardo DiCaprio is very good, and I thought he was great in Wolf of Wall Street, and much better, well, it's different demands, but I thought he was terrific in that.
When he's he's all tied up and his son's being killed in front of him and he can't move because he's just been burgled by the bear?
Yeah. Mike Nichols said a film is like a person. You either like it or you don't.
Uh-huh.
It happened quite quickly. I just wasn't... My feeling is that, especially with Oscar-winning films, that there's almost... Well, there are two things. One is, I think, virtually every film that wins the Oscar now needs to have a story about how the film was made. Because you need to read about a film and hear how great it is. And that's... That narrative is more important than the narrative of the film.
Right.
So it felt that the narrative of how difficult it was to make it became the true story of the film, and that was very important to it. Whereas with something like Mulholland Drive, you just go, I don't know, David Lynch is a genius. You don't really know. Who knows how he does it? There's no brilliant story behind it other than it was a TV pilot and now it's not. But that's not a great... triumph over adversity story. I think they all have that. And the other thing is, I feel that with virtually every film that's won the Oscar for a while, you would only really want to watch it once.
Uh-huh.
or everything you can get from it feels like it comes out in one viewing. Whereas I don't feel that's the same of, say, even Pulp Fiction, or I don't think that's a film where, you know, you're probably going to want to watch it again. I don't know whether the same is true of, I don't know, Birdman.
We're halfway through the podcast. I think it's going really great. The conversation's flowing like it would between a geezer and his mate.
All right, mate.
Hello, geezer. I'm pleased to see you.
Ooh, there's so much chemistry. It's like a science lab of talking.
I'm interested in what you said.
Thank you.
There's fun chat and there's deep chat. It's like Chris Evans is meeting Stephen Hawking.
Okay, we're now resuming our conversation in a very pretty street. I mean, it seems like the set from a film itself, and it's so colourful.
The pink floor.
Yeah. We're talking about Oscars. And what was your theory, that it all went a bit weird after?
Well, the 70s were pretty good. And
right.
Then,
so best picture, well, Oscars in the 70s.
The French Connection, Godfather, The Conversation, Last Picture Show. It was a quite good run of films in the early 70s. Taxi Driver.
Taxi Driver was nominated but didn't win.
Yeah. Who won in that year? Which film?
I'll tell you who won in 76.
Rocky.
Rocky. 74. Beating out All the President's Men, Bound for Glory, like Network, and Taxi Driver.
Yes.
Rocky's better
than
those.
What was 74? Godfather 2 or something?
So 74 was, yeah, Godfather 2, beating out Chinatown, The Conversation, Lenny, and The Towering Inferno. Who's the star of The Towering Inferno? It's
combustible material.
Anyway, so that's what the 70s were like. And then 1980...
Ordinary People beating Raging Bull.
Beats Raging Bull and The Elephant Man.
Yes.
And then it's Chariots of Fire and Gandhi and Terms of Endearment and those big emotional,
yes,
message movies.
Well, Mel Brooks said that Ordinary People would one day be the answer to a trivia question. Said The Elephant Man will be seen as a great film.
Oh, yeah. Well, Ordinary People's very much a kind of TV movie drama thing, isn't it? Albeit very well crafted,
yes,
one. Terms of Endearment.
Right.
Won,
yeah.
Best picture in 1983. This is, we're doing like a sort of...
I mean, anyone with access to Wikipedia.
Yeah, we're just reading out the names,
yes,
of films.
That, of course, starred Jack Nicholson, James Earl Brooks, of course.
Was the
Helmed
producer.
Now, who directed it? Was it James Earl Brooks as well?
I don't know.
I'm just reading your Wikipedia.
Yeah, and I've turned off data roaming
because
I don't want to get
that's
charged
wise.
Too much.
But I do think it benefits a film to have a good story around it, because the awards campaign seems to be so long that the more meat there is, as it were, whatever the heck that means, but if there's a good story about how it was made, or even if it's based on a true story, then you've got the true story to talk about and,
yeah,
how the film relates to the true story. And then if you have stars, they're always at a certain point in their careers or lives, and so there's a narrative to talk about with them and how they're doing. And then if the shoot was incredibly difficult or challenging in some kind of way, that's another good narrative. I think it's harder to write about, in some ways, the Coen brothers, even though they won the Oscar for No Country for Old Men, but it's hard to say a lot about them other than they seem great and really interesting, but there's not a lot of drama surrounding them, is there? Whereas there's something about writing about William Friedkin, it just goes chaos and people being slapped and mistakes and drugs,
well,
and excess,
yeah,
and it's a better story than here are two very intelligent, diligent men who, without much conflict, seem to consistently produce very good films. And here's another one.
Do you think there's a chance that one day you will sit down and The Revenant will come on?
Right.
And you will think, oh, I have totally misjudged this film. It is terrific stuff. Has that ever happened with any film that you've
seen initially and thought, no. And then you've seen its charms later on?
Yeah, I think it does happen. I remember my favourite of the Three Colours trilogy was red, whereas now I think blue might be. So that's a bit of a volte-face. I thought we were going to have an hour-long talk about Hanukkah and guilt.
Oh, yeah.
I've got to do a Hanukkah guilt.
I feel like I don't know enough about... I've only seen Funny Games.
I think that one really is an actual provocation and the film made to say, OK, you think you enjoy violent films. I'm going to make a violent film that you just can't enjoy.
Really?
It just isn't going to be fun. It's going to be horrible for you and it's going to stop any cathartic moment existing for you.
So can you do a synopsis for anyone who hasn't seen that film?
Well, Funny Games is about a bourgeois couple who go to stay in their country retreat. It's a couple and a young boy, and two, I don't know what you'd call them, they're not exactly burglars, they're two kind of torturers, appear.
They look like totally regular posh neighbours.
Yes, but they're almost like clown figures. There's a kind of shrewd, older one. Well, not necessarily older one, and a kind of plump, more dumb one. They're almost like stock Reformation drama characters.
Uh-huh.
And they slowly torture and kill them. And that's the film.
And you keep thinking, or at least I did, that surely it can't go that way. And normally in a film like that, the family would somehow turn the tables.
One would get away.
Yeah.
They're completely in control, these torturers. One winks at the camera, a bit like in Tom Jones, the Tony Richardson film. But there's a very, I guess, remarked upon moment where you feel there's going to be that cathartic moment where the woman who's been brutalized manages to escape for a moment, grabs a gun and shoots her assailant, but then the other assailant just grabs a remote control, rewinds the film that you are watching, and his accomplice isn't killed. So it has, I guess, I don't know, what would you call that?
Well, I guess that's postmodern, isn't it? Or meta at the very least.
But interestingly, before that, it lapses into the kind of film language and grammar that's consistent with those kind of thrillers, so that when that bad guy, as it were, is shot, you feel a moment of relief, and then the moment of relief is denied you, that he's going, no, you're not going to have that moment of relief. So it's a really unpleasant experience, and not a film I would particularly ever want to watch again. I guess it's vaguely interesting as him saying, well, this really is what part of violent films are you enjoying? And he has a moral point to make about the consumption of violence as entertainment.
You see, if only I'd known all that before I'd gone to see it. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about him.
Yeah.
I was told it was good. I went to see it, took it completely at face value,
right,
and was confronted by this sort of appalling scene that it was sufficiently well made and,
yes,
and acted that I was invested in what was happening and all the characters.
Yeah.
And this horrific scene just unfolded and ruined my day.
Yeah, I mean, it's horrible. Like, I think he said something like the only correct response to the film is to leave.
I mean, the way that you explained and unpacked Funny Games just now, you know, I find that really interesting.
Right.
And exciting and compelling. I just wish I hadn't seen the actual film. But the idea of what he's doing as a piece of work, rewinding the film so that the audience is denied that cathartic stock outcome, is brilliant.
There is an argument for saying, well, okay, well, don't do it to me.
Yeah.
I'm on your side, you know. And exactly, there is a problem.
That's the thing, is that it was an art house film, wasn't it?
Yeah, you're kind of punishing the people. Yeah.
By a huge...
It's not like everyone who likes Saw went, hey, Funny Games is on. I've heard that's even... Hang on. Hanukkah's self-reflexivity has made me question my enjoyment of it. And I think he has moved away from that in the... I don't know. It's very interesting. I think he has a preoccupation with guilt, being an Austrian.
Uh-huh.
And there's a good deal of guilt to process, I guess, there. And how do you get through life as a bourgeois person consuming resources around these terrible circumstances of poverty and sadness and grimness? How do you live?
You punish the rest of the bourgeoisie with your obscure films.
But in some ways, you know that. Isn't that partially what very good writers do? Is that they say, what the hell do you think you're doing? I don't know, even if it's like Hard Times by Dickens, changing the poor law, or...
Yeah.
You sometimes need
absolutely
a brain like his to go, you need to really take a look at this.
Hey, there are moments in everybody's life. Some are big and some are small moments. I have done a selection of the big moments from my mind. Now I'm going to share them with you all. Moments, big moments.
Moments, big moments. Moments, big moments. Moments, big moments. Moments, big moments. Moments, big moments.
Yes, how are you? How are you bearing up?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, this is fun for me.
Good.
I don't know if I'll watch... I don't know if I'll watch it when it's broadcast.
No, you mustn't. No one must.
No.
It'd be best if... the whole thing was buried in a wood, but
I like the show. I would watch it with other people on it.
Sadly, I'm in them, so I can't watch them.
Do you not like watching yourself on TV?
No, no. Never. You like watching yourself?
Well, I was saying, we were talking about this, and I used to, when me and Joe did stuff together, when it was stuff that we'd shot ourselves,
yes,
and we'd edited it, and I knew how it had turned out, I was really excited to watch it.
Had you gone through a period of dissociation by watching your face repeatedly that it became another person?
I just found that the experience of watching something that I had not made myself, i.e. appearing on someone else's program and making TV in a more traditional way, it was much more of a shock when I saw my stupid face at the end of it.
Because you weren't managing the manner of the presentation.
Yeah, exactly, because I hadn't been there to service my own vanity.
Service your own face.
Yeah.
Shepherd your own face to its best advantage. Yes.
So have you thought of a big moment?
Well, you know, the real answer is so sappy. It would be my wedding. Would be that.
Yeah.
Not specifically...
Is it possible to have a sparkling water, please?
Sparkling water, a liter?
God, I'm just in the middle of I was going to open my heart. And
I know.
You just,
are you okay with sparkling water? What are you going to have, Richard?
I'm going to have an Americano, please.
Americano. Coffee, okay.
And maybe a sparkling water as well.
Yeah, so we'll just get a liter and we'll share it. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
So, yeah, you were about to get sincere time in recorded history.
No, but, you know, I can't really... it'd be too sappy. It'd be you to had do a good... with meeting my wife and marrying my wife and all of that. In some ways, the idea of a moment is maybe problematic anyway.
All right.
Because otherwise it feels like there's this really good thing and then... Do you know what I mean? I think that's probably...
Yeah, but I'm talking about moments in your life where you've just had a little momentary epiphany, you know what I mean? And thought, hey, I'm actually enjoying myself, or, oh my gosh... I've suddenly understood something about the way life works, or I must make sure I never do this ever again.
Well, you know, there's a current almost trope which you get on websites, which is a picture of something and the headline is something, that moment when, I don't know a good example, that moment when we realised Jennifer Lawrence was a hoot.
Yeah.
Which has been established now scientifically.
She is.
But I see a lot written about hootage and Jennifer Lawrence being correlated, and I never really look at the thing that substantiates that moment. But partially because I feel a small spike of irritation
for the, reducing life to a series of moments.
Yeah, that it's a
that's
bit
the
like
the whole point of this section of the.
But you
the
know,
podcast.
It's a bit like a Bacardi Breezer advert or something that you just go these moments, that bit when you were running,
I did
and
a
this other thing
jingle.
That happened. Okay.
Did a jingle.
I'm anti moment.
Jesus Christ.
I think I'm anti moment.
Yeah.
I'm pro slow, protracted.
Yeah, but that's what the main business of life is, slow, protracted realizations and gradual transitions.
Yes, that's good.
I'm talking about those. There are times, though, when
Joyce
it's not
and epiphanies.
Like that. Yeah.
You're after those.
When you just suddenly think, ooh, I'm genuinely happy and carefree.
Okay, well, those things would be happy and would be to do with meeting my wife and things like that, which
right.
I, you know, what am I going to say about that?
Right,
in
well,
a way that isn't just
okay, what about
humiliating
a,
for
did you ever have a moment when you were making films, Submarine or The Double, where you thought, okay, this is what it's all about?
Casting is quite interesting in that it can feel terrible for a long time, and then someone comes along whereby the absolute dead nature of the thing that you have been involved with writing suddenly feels metabolized by that person, and that's exciting in that you feel, oh, this could be possible now.
Which actor did you have that with, or which was one of the actors you had that with?
With the film Submarine that I did, it was with Craig and Yasmin, because Sally Hawkins and Paddy, I knew a tiny bit.
Paddy Considine.
Yeah. So I just asked them, you know, I'd seen enough of them to go, they'll be really good, and they're always really good. And the same with Noah Taylor, who I just loved for a long time since a film called Flirting.
Mm-hmm.
And The Year My Voice Broke, which was the sort of precursor to that film.
Yeah.
So that was a big relief, because I hadn't, you know, I guess doing comedy, quite often there's a gang of you and you know who's roughly going to be in it and who's going to be doing what. But the idea of writing a whole thing and then trying to find someone to be in it was quite daunting, especially a young actor.
And but, so did you skip home that day after his audition, metaphorically?
I probably didn't. I probably just felt slightly less anxious for a bit.
Right.
And went, okay.
Have you always been anxious and sort of self-conscious?
I think I have always been quite anxious. Well, comfortable in certain areas. Well, Chris Dickens, who's an excellent editor, who co-edited the two films I've done, he told a story about how he did art at school and was, I think, pretty good at art, and he was always destroying his work and just going, it's not good. And the way he described it, it didn't sound like it was petulant, but it was more just a, and I think it's what makes him a really good editor, is that there's something in him that's always niggling and going, ugh, it's not quite there, which I think is quite a good quality for an editor to have. And I suppose that sense of always going, ugh, I'm not really sure this is good enough. Is that the same as being anxious? It might be.
Well, it's a form of anxiety. You're never quite content.
Yes, you're always thinking, yeah. And there are brief moments of respite from that. Like, for example, on both Submarine and The Double, there's this camera called the Arri 2C, which Stanley Kubrick used a lot. And finding that camera was really exciting, and every time we used that, it was great. And
what's so great about it?
Well, it's non-sync, so you can't quite get it to do 24 frames.
Uh-huh.
So it flutters, it's not quite real speed. And when you look at some of the handheld and Kubrick films, there's something a bit off about it. And also the camera's quite light, so you move it in a slightly different way than you do a more heavy 35mm camera.
Yeah.
So it has more exaggerated movement in every respect. The lenses are old, they're uncoated, they do strange things.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, so those moments...
Just serving us some drinks there.
We were just thanking ourselves for that conversation.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Adam.
Thanks for that insight.
Thanks for listening to me prattle on.
Those were little moments where you were having fun.
And there are lots of moments where something comes off and you go, oh, that works, I can't believe it. Or when you first edit two shots together and they work. I remember that. And it does seem like a magic trick that two things filmed at a different time cut together and it makes sense. It just seems preposterous. So I remember that when that first happened and me thinking I really like doing this.
And those were all moments on Submarine, were they?
Well, that was probably doing Garth Marenghi.
Oh, yeah. Well, you guys used to spend so much time and care on the actual construction, technically, of the thing, on the soundtrack, and
yeah,
all those elements had been considered, and that must have been such fun, wasn't it?
Yes, that was. Although we were pretty angsty about it all the time, and always thinking it didn't work, and we could make this thing better, and you know, it took ages.
Yeah,
but like, I mean, the sound, say on the double, took 4 months. You might say that's a misuse of time.
No, not at all. Because
something they can get into.
I think people appreciate it. They notice it. And yeah. You, I mean, you're
on their iPhones.
Yeah, you've seen that bit of David Lynch.
On an iPhone.
On a fucking phone. If you haven't seen it, listeners, it's David Lynch vocalising his outrage at the idea that people would watch a film on their phone. And that's the first time they've seen it.
He said something like, "You may think you've had an experience, but you've had nothing."
You see, I don't agree with him.
Okay.
I think that that is something that is sometimes true with certain films.
Yeah.
But I think you can,
like, the last
immerse
Airbender.
Yourself. Maybe it's true with... I think Airbender has to be seen in a large, hushed cinema to get the most out of it.
Yeah.
But I think there are a lot of films that you can really immerse yourself in.
Yes.
And that you are drawn into, regardless of where you see them. And if you're engaged, if a movie engages you, you know, you can watch it on a plane and it still makes a big impression.
I think it's possible. I think it's harder.
It's different. It's different, right?
It's hard, you know, when you know you can pause it. And in some ways, you want a film to magnify things.
Yeah.
It's harder to do that.
No, listen, I'm not saying it's ideal.
Hey, that's exactly what you're saying, and that's why I'm not letting you get away with it. You were directly contradicting Lynch.
Hello, Adam Buxton here again. This part of the conversation was recorded at a cafe in the Largo di Carmo Square while the crew got set up to shoot a sequence in the nearby Elevador de Santa Justa, a lift that takes travellers to Lisbon's higher streets and affords an impressive view of the city. I recalled a friend of mine commenting on an interview they'd seen with Richard on Channel 4 News. My friend said that it seemed rather a tense exchange, so I wanted to ask Richard about it, but I should have reminded myself of the clip before asking him. I've watched it properly since then, and it was obviously supposed to be funny, but it was interesting hearing Richard's take on the whole interview process in general. So here I am, telling him what my friend said to me.
Did you see that interview that Richard Ayoade did with Krishnan Gurumurthy?
Okay.
When you were promoting your book?
Mm-hmm.
Ayoade on Ayoade.
Yeah.
Which was kind of a spoofy film book.
Yes.
And what was the deal there? You went on and you sort of deconstructed the interview.
Well, I didn't think I was particularly... What happened in my subjective take on it was that the person who's running publicity for Faber, who published the book, said, "Would you like to go on Channel 4 News?" Obviously, no. I mean, not particularly, as in I wasn't sitting around going, "Oh, yes, I'd love to." As soon as the opportunity presents itself, I'll go. But it was fine, and I said, "That seems strange, because this isn't news in any way that I understand." And they said, "No, they've got a new sort of strand on with a...
someone, culture section.
Culture, yeah. Strand, or whatever." And I went, "Okay." And then Krishnan Gurumurthy, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, T-H rather than P-H.
Yeah, Murthy. Who'd have a name that's unpronounceable? I mean, the disgrace of it. Phoned me to do a pre-interview and just say what we'll discuss. So the subject that I was being asked to talk about was interviews. They said, "Do you want to come on and talk about interviews?" Because I think in a previous print interview, I said I find the interview situation somewhat awkward. And they said, "Well, do you want to talk about that?" To which you might say, well, inherent in my position, perhaps no, not that much, but fine. I'm happy to talk about the fact that I find it awkward in some way. That's okay.
Yeah.
And then when he phoned, he said, would you like to talk about race in the media? And I said, well, you know, that seems relatively broad as a subject. And my concern would be, if I'm meant to be talking about interviews with some tangential connection to a book, of which there will be a picture during the interview, and therefore it's somewhat promotional, I don't know whether you can just show up, say something about it, and retreat back into your little cage. If you're going to talk about something substantial...
Show up, say something about race, you mean?
And then withdraw as someone who isn't particularly accountable for what they say.
Yeah.
I sort of go, well, what would make me a person that should be listened to on that, when really the only reason I'm on this is probably because I have a book to talk about, which already is a bit of a dodgy reason to be on the news. I don't know. So I said, yeah, I mean, you can ask, but I don't have any piercing insights. This is 4 minutes long, isn't it? How long are we really going to be able to unpack it? What am I going to say exactly? I don't know. We'd have to see. And so when it happened, he sort of started in a kind of jocular way, and then what I thought I did was just try to go along with the jokey tone that he'd established. But I got the sense that there was some information going into the earpiece which was like, come on, let's steer it back to something sensible. You can't just
going
mess around
into his
here.
Earpiece, you thought.
I felt so,
yeah.
But I didn't know. But and also I thought in some ways you're vaguely booked as a comedian in some ways. Aren't you meant to in some ways be silly?
Yeah.
I don't think I'm really meant to go, hey, look, let's sort out some issues here. Because I don't have a mandate for that from the public.
Right.
I find it somewhat, I don't know, a bit silly when someone tries to grab the conch.
Yep.
And sound off. But at the time, it didn't feel like anything had happened. It felt no different to any interview that I've ever done, which is somewhat glib and substantial and a bit awkward.
What feedback did you get from it?
Nothing. I think because he'd done an interview before with Quentin Tarantino, which had ended awkwardly, and then it became like, oh, he's the awkward
interview guy.
But I don't know. I also don't think you have to answer every question.
No.
That's posed to you.
Well,
I guess maybe the thing was just that you're on the news,
yeah.
Take it seriously. And maybe I didn't take it seriously.
Right.
But I didn't know that it was my job to take it seriously while promoting a comedy book.
Did you see the Tarantino interview that he did?
Yes. I liked it. I kind of thought Tarantino was okay. He was a tiny bit bad-tempered and brusque, maybe.
He seemed quite irritated.
But I did think...
Did you think it was a cheap shot from Krishnan?
I just don't quite...
So, listeners, again, if you didn't see, this was an interview with Tarantino to promote... What was the film?
Maybe it was Django Unchained, was it? Or
Inglourious
Bastards,
maybe? Bastards
or something.
Anyway, it was around that sort of time. And I think at some point Krishnan Gurumurthy... He asked him about the possible link between... movie violence and real life violence, whether it has any effect.
Yes.
And Tarantino just immediately got irritated and dismissed that line of questioning out of hand and said, you know, come on, I can't believe you're wheeling out that old chestnut.
Yes. I think that's okay, though.
Yeah.
As in, I mean, I didn't find Krishnan's questions annoying or irritating as they happened. I just thought...
In your interview you were talking about.
Yeah, in the interview I did, and I just didn't feel I was really being asked to be present as a serious correspondent.
Yeah.
And I suppose also Tarantino was within his rights to go, I don't want to answer any of these questions, or I do or not. He's not a representative of anyone other than himself. I suppose you could say he's a representative of his film and of the people who funded his film. But beyond that, I don't know that he has to say anything else. But I didn't think, answer the question, Tarantino, you're on the news.
Right.
Did you feel that?
I thought it was sort of silly to get irritated by. I thought it was a legitimate question and an interesting area of
You know, yes. It's like an interesting topic.
But also, I think sometimes, I remember seeing an interview with Paul Thomas Anderson where someone was saying, have you shown Tom Cruise the Master?
Uh-huh.
And he kind of went, oh, come on, what am I going to say? You sort of go, you're asking to disclose a private conversation at that stage. Why should he have to disclose that? I think there can be too much of an accent on the idea that if you ask anything, somehow the person has to just give it up.
Yes, yield and it. Also that people should be 100% consistent in everything they say and do.
Yeah, or just on board. As if by agreeing to show up to something, the idea is that you are liable for full disclosure.
Right.
But I don't know that that's a contract. You can say, well, let's see how it goes. We'll meet up, let's see how it goes.
Uh-huh.
I think that can be a good contract. Isn't that every human interaction?
No! No, 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 no! No! No, 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 no! 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 No!
This is an advert for Squarespace.
Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right, stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No, it's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial and I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul, and I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts and I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.
Oh, there goes the hairy bullet. Super fast. Rosie's happy. You know, Rosie, in Rosie's world, everything's going fine. We're going for a walk, and it's a nice evening. So, what's the problem? No one's shouting racist abuse at Rosie. And she's going to get fed tonight, and... it's all good. Would that we all lived in that world. That's my deep thought for the day. Anyway, listen, folks, that's it for this podcast with Richard Iowede. And tomorrow you will find a whole other one, podcast number 25, which features more conversations from our time filming in Lisbon. And in part two, Richard and I enjoy some pillow talk. We talk about pillows, so that's quite a funny thing for me to say. There's more big moments, and we have a serious talk about a serious subject. And let's face it, there's enough of those around these days, you know? Oh, thanks very much indeed to Seamus Murphy Mitchell for production support. Cheers, Seamus. You're the best. Right. Off to sort this Rosie vote out. There's no, I'm not going to do a Rosie vote. I think you know that, don't you? All right, take care, listeners. Be nice to each other. Or I will hurl abuse at you. And then the whole thing will just roll on. Take care. I love you. Bye!